Welcome to the podcast. I'm Joanna Colbert, and you're listening to The Casting Session. I decided to create this podcast out of a desire to help actors feel more confident in their auditions. This podcast is an inside look at filmmaking through the perspective of casting. In these interviews, I'm going to provide you with in-depth, enlightening, fun conversations with the industry's top casting directors, actors, directors, and producers. We're going to cover a range of topics, like the audition process, and the role casting plays in the collaboration with directors, and the overall craft of casting. Basically, we're giving you a behind-the-scenes look into the casting process. So without further ado, I bring you The Casting Session. Welcome to the Casting Session podcast, everyone. My guest today is Guy Burnett. I'm so excited to have Guy on today. You know Guy from Ray Donovan, The Affair, from his theater work, and Pitch Perfect 2, and so many others. So, Guy.
Hello, Joanna. Thanks for having me on.
I will start by asking you about how you got started. I read that you were a footballer, perhaps professionally, or...
You know, my world was very different when I started out. I really didn't have any connection to the entertainment business in any way. All I cared about was sports, really. And I played football, yeah, but I think it was soccer. But I loved that and I loved boxing. Those were my two sports. And when I was growing up, my focus was really on those two things more than anything else. And when I realized I just wasn't good enough, then I had to turn my sights on to something else.
But don't you feel that that experience informs your acting somehow? And if so?
Absolutely. Failing at something so early on and also learning that it wasn't necessarily to do with ability. You know, in hindsight, really, I look back and I go, yeah, no, I had the talent and I had the ability. I just don't think I had the psychological awareness to deal with the kind of politics around it, which I think a lot of industries have. And, you know, I was kind of just accepting of like, oh, they're telling me I'm not good enough, so I'm probably not. And then to go into, you know, especially into this field, into acting, that was a huge lesson. Suddenly I was like, hold on a minute. You know, most people don't know what they're talking about, including myself. And it's truly just the belief that you have in yourself. And that wavers, that's gone up and down, but I'm happy that I failed in a different occupation before I started this one, because that taught me a lot. And then now today, I've been from, you know, drama schools to acting classes to coaches to this, and, you know, I try and take a bit from everywhere. And I was talking about this the other day. I box a lot still. I still do martial arts, and I learned so much from the fighters. I learned so much from the people I'm training with. I'm learning so much from watching even interviews or, you know, educating myself on how these boxers and MMA fighters deal with their careers, because they also, there's a certain level of talent. And then there's that small percent which have really succeeded. And it's not been purely based on their ability. It's also to do with how they've approached it psychologically. They basically, like an act, you know, they prepare, they train towards a fight, and they'll train for 3 months, let's say, ahead of the fight, or whatever, you know, let's say 6 weeks, 7, 8 weeks. And if they overtrain, they can lose. They won't be present. If they undertrain, they won't be ready. But more than anything else, they have to let go of all the work that they've done when they get into that ring, or if they get into the octagon. And if they do not, and they are not present, then they're probably going to lose. And in essence, that's kind of the same thing as what we go through. Just we don't get punched in the face.
That's a wonderful analogy. It really is. Don't undertrain, don't overtrain, don't underprepare, don't overprepare. Once you're there on the set or the stage, you have to do a certain amount of surrendering to the gods, shall we speak.
100%. And I really believe that. I was working with David Thewlis, and he's very much of that sort of like, just like, hey, you know, if God gives us a gift of some sort, then, you know, you mustn't turn away from it. And he had learned his lesson. He told me this amazing story. He was working with this great Italian director. He said to me that he was on set, and the scene was he was mid-argument with his wife in the scene, and he came running in and the floor was slippy and he slipped and he smacked himself onto the floor, and he said he was in pain and he was kind of wincing, and he himself said, all right, let's stop, let's cut then, we'll go again. And the Italian director came running in and was screaming at him and said to him, you just said fuck you to God. How dare you say fuck you to God? He gave you a gift and you told him fuck you to God. And he said that this stayed with him for so long that anytime anything happens in a scene that isn't planned or accidental or anything like this, he just hears that director in the back of the head going, don't say fuck you to God. Don't say fuck you to God. You know, I love that story because it's true. It's like, don't stop. Don't stop. Just keep going. Just go, because it's real life, you know?
Right. Oh, that's great. Oh, my goodness. And yes, this idea of surrendering and like sort of being in alignment and sharing our gifts. It's like the bigger picture of what we're doing.
Yeah. And that's part of the risk. My fault that I look at sometimes is I can be a bit controlling of my performance. Oh, I want to be angry here or emotional here. Or, when I was doing a play in New York about 5-6 years ago, I look back on it and I have so many regrets about it, because as I do with any job sometimes, but with that one, I just remember being so controlled of my performance and I was trying to perfect it every single night because I thought I was in search of this perfect performance. And there was one day, like a matinee, where the whole day had gone wrong for me. Like I'd been running around and all this, and I turned up to the theater like 5 minutes before the performance, which is super unlike me. I'm always on time and ready to go well before the curtain goes up. But this time it was all last minute. And when I look back on it, it was by far and away my best performance. I struggle to let go sometimes. And, you know, I'm shooting a movie at the moment and I'm noticing at times when I'm not letting go. You know, the risk is just to, you know, if nothing does happen, nothing happens.
Yeah, that's where the sports analogy comes in again, which is like if you're in the boxing ring or on the football field, you can't be thinking. You have to be completely in the moment.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. And then I tell you, the people who are at the very top in the MMA world, the boxing world, I'm sure in other sports too, but these specific people, the people that I'm talking with daily when I'm training, is that it is the ones that they know to do the work and let go once they're in the ring. And whatever happens, happens. There's a rhythm, there's the movement, you know, and it's all the conversations we have. We have all these kind of philosophical conversations. I could be in a room full of actors really having this conversation, but I'm just in a room full of these fighters.
So then how did you go from the sports to the acting?
Yeah, it didn't work out for me. I moved around Europe. I was living abroad and I learned other languages, which was great as well. But I came back and I was still young. I was like turning 18. And this was really my only connection to the entertainment or the, you know, the theater world, if anything. My mum worked as a chambermaid in the hotel for many years and then became a receptionist. And so I grew up in this little hotel in London, and the owner of the hotel was a super interesting guy. He was an Auschwitz survivor and he would translate Spanish plays. And when I got back, I really was depressed with nothing to do at all. I loved film. I loved cinema. You know, I was a huge fan. Like when I was younger, me and my mates, we would hide at the Gate Cinema in Notting Hill. And they used to play all these indie films. And I remember once we were in there and we would never watch it. We wouldn't give a shit about it. And then one day La Haine was on, a French movie. It's a great film. That's actually the reason, like, you know, me, my friend Sheridan, my friend Azzy, you know, I was a white guy, a Jewish guy, an Arab guy, and, you know, a black guy. And we were watching our lives in that movie. It was like one day in Paris and all this shit was going down. And weirdly enough, and we kind of attribute it to La Haine, but we ended up in the film industry, all of us. Like my friend Azzy's a writer, my friend Sheridan is directing, Azzy's also directing, you know, and I ended up doing it because I was obsessed with Vincent Cassell. I just thought he was mesmerizing. But none of that was real. It wasn't realistic. You know, where we came from, there was no one who was doing that. There was no one we knew who was in that world. We just, you know, focused on sports, came back because I failed in that. And I started working as an apprentice to my mum's boss. And I would just, he would do like read-throughs for his plays and stuff. If an actor wouldn't turn up, I would do it. And a lot of this is just luck. You know, I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think my dad or someone, it was like walking his dog in the park. And there was an agent's assistant who had a dog. And he'd be like, oh, my son's doing his read-through. You should go and watch him. They came to watch me and they were like, you know, we'd like to represent you and we'll sit with you through drama school. It's like, get the fuck out of here. I'm not going, no, that's not my world. I'm not doing this shit. And also, like, you know, they were so weird, all these people who were doing these plays. Like, I don't know what was wrong with them, you know, and it was just a different world to mine. And they stuck on me. It was this agent in London called Andrew Manson, who he's passed away since, and it was a small agency, really sweet guy. I said, all right, let's see what happens with the drama schools. And then we got in to a lot of really good ones, and then I saw how much it cost, and I couldn't get, like, you know, I was like, I'm not paying that. We don't have money for that. And they were like, don't worry, we'll figure it out. And like maybe a couple of weeks before I was going to start, they sent me on my first audition for this television show in the UK, just a soap opera, right? And I got it. I don't know how. I do know how. I got it because I kind of looked like the girl that they had hired to play my sister. And so I moved to Liverpool because I was like, I'm getting paid to do this. Yeah, I'll go and do it. So it was circumstances just kind of happened that way. I moved to Liverpool and I did this show, and then they made my part bigger, and then they gave me this cool storyline which became very popular for the show. And during that time, it was kind of my training ground for all the mistakes I went through. They shot single camera as opposed to multiple cameras, so you kind of got that kind of very cinematic feel to the way at least it was shot, that kind of training. And yeah, I made a lot of mistakes. I was terrible sometimes, better at other times, saw what worked, saw what didn't. And then at some point during it, I got ambitious. I thought I'm good at this in terms of my approach to it. You know, I wasn't acting by the numbers. It was just kind of more like a bit more wild and like, let's, you know, what happens in the scene happens in the scene. Kind of enjoyed that element of it. And I decided to leave when it was kind of at its peak of the story. And I left with, you know, a lot of people told me I shouldn't have done and were telling me not to. But I did. I would watch films that I loved and I was like, why can't I do that? And really, most people around were going, no, you can't. And I was like, but I couldn't understand why I couldn't. And, you know, I moved back down to London and I couldn't really get any meetings or auditions for anything that I wanted to do. Anything that was on offer to me was, not that I was blasé necessarily too, but it was parallel to what I'd been doing. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted my chance to do something else. I couldn't get it. It's crazy. Like I love England. I love London. It's, you know, it's always my home. The industry itself is very structured in England. There's a hierarchy. There's a way. You have to do it this kind of way. And you've got to put in, you know. So, and it's probably changed now. I mean, you're talking about, you know, 15 years ago. And I couldn't get in the room. So I was like, what am I doing? You know, I, there was, you know, and then I thought, oh, maybe if I change agencies, you know, I need to get a better agent. And then you become obsessed about agents and shit like that. I mean, a lot of young actors come to me and like, what agent? I'm like, don't worry about that, man. Just focus on the work. That will come, you know. I was just turned down by everyone. And for what reason? I don't know. You know, they probably had their reason, or they just didn't believe that I would succeed or get, or they'll be able to get me there. I don't know, you know. And then a lot of that built a lot of resentment in me, like anger, a lot of anger that, you know, why not give me a chance? You know, why are they rejecting? You know, it was not fair. I mean, one guy was like, yeah, I'll take you on, and then just never called me back. That is kind of the thing that today I thank that guy for, because it motivated me. I could have stopped, like I stopped with football, you know, I could have stopped with that. Like that, because those are the reasons I stopped playing sports. But I didn't, because of those lessons, I didn't stop. I didn't allow him, like, who the fuck is this guy to tell me, you know, and I pushed with anger sometimes, but, you know, with still motivated, and nothing was happening. So I took the money that I'd earned during those few years that I was on that show, and I left and I went to New York. And I thought I'd go to drama school in New York. You know, I applied to Tisch and I applied to, and I went to like that Uta Hagen one. I went everywhere. I like just trained, got bits and bobs off everyone. And then, you know, I started meeting managers over there, and I felt America was a lot more open to the idea of giving someone an opportunity and seeing what happens. And I met a manager in New York who I'm not with now, but, you know, I miss dearly. And I look back on it, and she was really wonderful. Her name was Myrna Jacoby. And she kind of plucked me out of nowhere and recognized something in me, which nobody had done. She was actually so ahead of her time. This was really before audition taping at home was, it was just on the verge of, like, it was the beginning of that. But she had seen that that was the way forward. And she instilled in me this work ethic where it was kind of terrible at the time. It was quite depressing. I had no life. I really mean that. I had a side job because I didn't have money. So, I'd work in a boxing gym cleaning up before hours and after hours. And then in between, you know, she'd try and get me auditions. And if she couldn't, her other clients who had auditions, she would send me the sides and I would tape them. And those tapes wouldn't even be sent anywhere. She would just hold on to them. So she had a library of tapes and they were never good enough. And if I did get an audition, I went into the room to audition, I would have to go home, tape that audition again to send to Myrna to analyze what I had done. This was 7 days a week, all the time. And thousands of thousands and thousands of tapes, and she would use those to try and get me the meetings and auditions. And then, you know, it just takes kind of one person to believe in you in that way. And Judy Henderson, a casting director in New York, she got it as well, and she liked it. And she was like, hey, there's this play, and, you know, it's the lead, so I don't, but just come in and read. And I did, and they liked it, and I kept going in again and again and again, and I got it. And that kind of was a chain reaction of things to come. Suddenly, because I was doing theatre, it meant I could act, which is a load of bullshit too, but you're still learning along the way. And I did this play, and a lot of people came to see the play. It got decent write-ups, and then it got a bit of momentum and progressed from there. And then you need that next person to believe in you, you know, because it was getting stale. Like Myrna and I, she would send me in for a lot of stuff. We'd go in for a lot of stuff, and sometimes it just wouldn't work. And I was like, what am I doing wrong? And, like, you know, and then she would get frustrated. And eventually we parted ways. And, you know, I was too naive, I think, to understand the hard work that she'd put in. And, you know, we're friends today. She's wonderful. But my work ethic, she's a lot to do with it. And but then there's other people along the way. There's, like, you know, I was going to quit after that, truly. Like, there was a point where I was just done. And I was in Los Angeles at that point. I was just like, I can't do this. I could feel Myrna was just like at the end of her rope as well. And I had a general meeting with John Patsadera. And I went in to meet him, and he was such a cool guy. And he sat with me, and we just talked about life. I think he could tell that I was just depressed. And he just got it. He understood. He said something to me that was super, I don't even want to repeat it because it sounds so conceited to say it. But, like, you know, he compared me to an actor that I love. And I was like, you really seen that? He's like, I see it 100%, 100%. He got it. And again, I was like, yeah. And I left there thinking, is this bullshit? But you know what? I'll give another week to LA. I'll give it another week, you know. My mum wants me back, and everyone wants me back. Like, just go back and do what you were doing to begin with. I gave it another week. And then Paps put me in this room with the director. And then they had seen some of the work that I'd done, and they were like, we love it. But the thing was already cast, but then there was a bit of momentum. I did fly back to London, but just before I flew back, I auditioned for a film that Paps was casting called Mordecai, which ended up being a whatever film, but it had big actors, man, and little old me's just auditioning for it. I felt I did a good one. Then I got to London, and I thought I could do better, so I taped. Or Myrna said, well, then tape it, do another take, I want to see. And I taped it, and I did this kind of improv thing, and she did it. And then the director saw it, Pat sent it to the director. And then I went to see a play in London, and I had not heard about the film. I'd not heard anything for weeks. And I'm at this play in London. I remember a couple come up to me just before the play, and they're like, oh my gosh, you're the guy who was in Hollyoaks, that TV show I did. And I was like, yeah, yeah, how you doing? You know, oh yeah, good, good. Whatever happened to you? And I was like, oh, you know, man, I tried and all of this kind of stuff. And they were like, oh, okay, cool, 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 cool. Well, good luck with everything. I'm like, thanks, thanks. You know, I went into the play, I sat in the play, come out at intermission, and I had a voice message of Myrna, who, and she was basically crying. And she was like, you got it. You know, you got this role with Johnny Depp and Ewan McGregor and Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, and I broke down. And it's like, it's not like it was a big part. It's not like it was in a moment in time, timing wise, that I needed it. And I kind of dropped to my feet. Dropped onto my knees. So melodramatic, man. And I just was just leaning on the wall. And then that couple came up to me and they go, you all right? Because they could see I was emotional. And I was like, yeah. And guess what? They were the first people I told. I got this job with Johnny Depp. And they're like, what? Oh my God, like, can we get your picture? I was like, yeah, okay. And I sat and I went back into the play. And there's been shit times after that too. And there's ups and downs and stuff. But that's kind of the beginnings of it to an extent.
And it just gave you what you needed to keep going.
Yes, I've realized there's an evolution to it. Every time there's like one step back, two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward, and it can kind of progress that way.
I think this is so helpful for our audience because I think a lot of people relate to this. I do. I think people feel that all we get are these little glimmers, and those little glimmers are, we can hold on to those and move forward and somehow get to a new level, but it's not like, okay, once you reach this, you're done with ever suffering again.
You know what I would want to hear, you know, I think I was telling you, is like what I would like to hear is just somebody being honest about what you do. You know, there's a lot of actors, you know, that, and I completely understand why, you know, because you got to put on this persona for the industry. Whereas I'd rather just like say, actually, you know what? It's shit sometimes. It's hard sometimes. And sometimes it's better. And then, you know, I still don't know really where I stand, but I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep pushing forward.
One of my favorite quotes is from Rumi, and it says, you have to be crumbled earth for the flowers to grow. And I think it's true, but it is what it is to be human. And perhaps the pandemic helped us get to this place of being completely stripped down, and what beautiful things can come at being in that place.
Yes, that's exactly how I feel with it all. And yeah, no, maybe the pandemic has kind of reset where we approach it, and maybe that's one of the setbacks. And you know, I think it just has to evolve. Everything has to evolve. And even when there is something like a pandemic, there's somehow, you know, the ones that flourish are the ones that kind of go like, all right, how do we evolve out of this? And I think our industry, every industry, is kind of having to adapt to it. And look, maybe we've just advanced 5 years with our approach to it all. And, you know, Myrna, to begin with, was right about this taping situation.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it's very challenging for actors to not be in the room where that alchemy happens with the director and the casting director. However, there is a silver lining. Casting directors are able to see hundreds, maybe thousands of more actors now than they ever could. I do hope we go back to a world where we're sitting in front of each other in those casting rooms.
For sure. I miss that interaction. And you know, sometimes, you know, I would have a list of the casting directors, and I would have ones where I much prefer to take, and ones where I like, no, I'd like to go in there. Or if it's somebody new that you haven't met, it's great to go in there so they feel your energy. I'll give you an example. I remember I went back to England about a year and a half ago, and I was with, you know, my agent in London, who I've been with for ages as well. Kat's lovely and really helps me out a lot there. She tries to navigate and finesse these relationships so they know and learn, like, oh, you know what, guy, remember that? But, you know, this is what he's doing now and all this kind of stuff, which is a tricky job, you know, because you're creating perception, you know, how do you do that? But there was a Christmas party that they had. And, you know, all the clients and all the agents and all that, and some casting directors and I go to the bar just to get a drink, and this lovely lady just starts having a chat with me. We talk about life, and she's like, "Where'd you grow up?" You know, I was like, "I grew up here, and this was my life." And she was like telling me about hers, and she goes to me, "You know, it's so interesting." She goes, "I know who you are." She goes, "I'm a casting director." And she said to me, "You know what, guy? Kat has been pitching you to me for years now." And I was like, "I don't know. Wasn't he the guy who did that? Or wasn't, you know?" And she goes, "I get it. I'm in front of you now and I get it. I'm going to call you in for this thing and that thing." And I was like, part of me was like, "Hold on a minute," you know, but then I was like going, "Look, that's just the way it is." And she did. It was a huge thing. And we got down to the wire and I got flown in and we chemistry read and all this kind of stuff. But she gets it now and she's in my corner and, you know, she knows what I'm capable of doing. And that happened because of us meeting in person. If one day I was to ever direct or anything like that, you know, I would, of course, want to see people read. I want to see people take. I want to see people do that. I don't know if I could ever cast somebody without meeting them in person and sit with them and understand who they are and what their essence is as a human being.
Essence is a word we use all the time on this podcast. It's everything, because a casting director's job is to click into the person's essence. And we're getting better at doing it over Zoom. It is possible. It really is. But yeah, there's no substitute for that in-person alchemy.
That's everything. I read stuff now, or if I have an audition for something now, I don't go, "Oh, I've got to learn the lines. I've got to do this, got to do that." You know, I just, what is the character? What is the narrative? What is the story? Okay, maybe I'll get a few things wrong, but I'll try and give you the essence of what I feel this is and what I can bring to it. I didn't used to do that. The evolution of the audition tape has taken years and just learning things along the way. You know, I used to push it. I would go for days and days and days, no joke, full days. I'm talking about not 12-hour days. I would do a full 18 hours of taping, watch it, didn't like it, do the next day. Then I went through a phase where I'd kind of create the scene, you know, and shit like that. And then a friend of mine, she's a French director, and she was doing this film, and there was a part that was perfect for me in it. And I thought, I'm going to tape for this. And I did a tape, and I knew that it was strong. I knew the performance was strong. I knew it was a good one. And she saw it, and all she said about it was like, "Why are you making it a mise-en-scene?" And I said, "Mise-en-scene? Like, what are you talking about?" Well, you know, the wallpaper, I guess I had a cigarette, so I was smoking and I was washing my face during it or something like that. And she just didn't dig it. But that also was another lesson. I was like, you know what? I gave my life and soul, but you didn't even see it because it was a, you know, mise-en-scene. Sounds so like arrogant anyway, but like, I get it. You know, now then I went back into even more simplicity. And that was another lesson that I learned when I was in New York with Myrna. After I'd done the play, I had auditioned for Orphans with Alec Baldwin was in it. And I'd gone in a couple of times. I thought I'd done really good work. They offered it to Shia LaBeouf. I went back to Myrna. I was like, bullshit. There's no way he's the actor that he got this. But I deserve it and stuff like that. That's how I felt, because I thought I'd done good work. And then, if I'm not mistaken, I think he left the play or he got fired from it. Something happened with that. Him and Alec didn't get on. It was like a known thing. And he dropped out and he posted either his tape for that play or on YouTube. And or he posted him just sitting at home and doing the whole play, just his role. And I watched it and I phoned up Myrna and I was like, I was so wrong. He is so good. He is so electric and he's so raw and he so doesn't give a shit. He's just there. He forgets a line at one point. He just tells the reader, he goes, wait, go back two lines. What was my line? And then they give it to him and he just carries on and he flows, man. And I was like, that's what it's about. You know, at least for me, and I know some people would disagree with that, but that was, I was like, wow, I've got to take this to a whole new level because he is way better than me.
Whoa. That's fascinating.
Yeah, that was a lesson.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, man.
Ah. I think these are great, great stories people want to hear. And we talk a lot on this podcast about essence, and we talk a lot about which casting directors like you to do sort of what we call a full performance in the room and which don't. I personally don't want a full performance. I feel like save that for the when you get hired. You know, you're not on set. It's a small, intimate space where you can trust me. If you say, you know what, all these casting directors I'm meeting know what they're doing. And all I have to do is show my essence and they can take it from there. They know who else is being cast. They're painting the canvas. They're having hours and hours and hours and hours discussion with the director. So I can trust that. And all I can do is show up and be myself and show them who I am. And that's either going to fit into this canvas or not. And maybe it'll fit into the next canvas they do.
Exactly right. I think the hard part, you know, and I speak for myself and I know others go through this, is that especially if you're going in the room, right? If you're there and you're waiting to go in, it's like going back to the fighter's analogy. They've done the work, they've got to let go. But you're doing the ring walk, you're backstage, you're doing the ring walk, and then you're getting into the octagon. There's a lot that's happening between that time. But psychologically, how do you get yourself to a place where I can just be present and not nervous and just give you that essence that you're talking about? But it goes back to like, just let go. Like, you know what? I'm going to meet Joanna today. I hope it works out. You know, let's see what happens. I'll give a little bit of my soul. Here's a little bit of my essence. And you know what? If it's my day and the circumstances are right and I'll try and create the circumstances to be correct, then rock and roll. And if it's not, we move on and we just got to press forward. I say that like it's simple for me, but it's not.
No, it's beautifully said. It is, Guy. And it is so important for the listeners to hear it from you. And how do we, in our daily lives, give ourselves the tools to be present? Whether it's meditating or breathing or mantras of reminding yourself to be in the moment, whatever it is, it's a daily struggle in human life to be present, especially with the chaotic world we live in. So yes.
I found it a lot easier in New York than I did in Los Angeles. And it was most of the time was because I could walk through the streets of Manhattan. You're always, you know, you're looking around and you've got to be very aware of your surroundings. You have to be present in New York. In LA, you kind of sat in your car for ages and then you kind of like park up and then you go in and then you're in the waiting room and it's like, come on, wake up. So I found it easier in New York.
We have a little section of the podcast called The Ritual, where I ask my guests about their morning coffee or tea ritual. So do you have one? You are English, right?
Yeah, I have a cup of tea, but I don't have it like the English have their tea. I used to drink a lot of like just black coffee, but I kind of cut out the caffeine a little bit. My morning ritual, I normally wake up and I stretch out and I brush my teeth and then I make a shake now most mornings, you know, the blender, just like, you know, banana and like some, I don't know, some healthy shit. And then, and I drink that and some, you know, fruits and stuff. And then I drink that before I eat anything. And then if I have the time, I'll go and train, you know, work out. I call my mum daily, you know. I have to, yeah, of course. I call my mum. You all right? Everything good? All right, great, okay.
That's great.
Yeah, that's it. I'm trying to think of it. I wish there was something more exciting to.
Well, you said you have tea in the morning with your shake.
Yeah, I'll have a tea now. Normally now I just have a green tea. Become poncy like that. I just have a green tea of what I got here. I at night time I have a 99 tea. You know, calm me down, put me to sleep. But yeah.
So listeners, call your mom every morning and have some fruits. Cut down on your caffeine. And I won't tell Rosie Fellner that you're not having a proper English tea.
No, please don't. She'll kill me. No, you know what? If I ever go and visit Rosie, then she always makes me a good cup of tea. And so I will have it with her. I just can't do it the way she does it.
If somebody makes it for you, who knows what they're doing?
You know what? I just remembered something going back to everything that because I heard your podcast, Joanne, before I came on, and I think I told you just before that the circumstances had it that Jessica Kelly was on, and the interesting thing that occurred from that because there were so many interesting things that she said on that podcast. And that's why I think what you're doing is great. And I think it's super important that actors hear this out, and you know, hopefully casting directors also get to hear it. Because some of the stuff she was saying, I was like going, okay, that's interesting. Okay. And then I happened to have an audition for her, and she's always doing interesting projects. I always spot her name before I even see the project. I go, oh, shall I audition for this? I don't know. And then I see her name, like, oh, it's probably interesting. And it happened at the exact same time I heard your podcast. She said something on there about, you know, sometimes they won't watch the full tape or they won't see the whole thing. And it played into the way I approached the tape that I did for her. And I switched around the scenes, and, you know, I don't know if it would have made a difference or not, but I wanted to approach it in the way that I heard her talk about it. And I got it, you know, and I'm filming it now. But that was thanks to what you had done.
Well, thank you, Kai.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's important for the listeners to understand that there's a lot of different mitigating factors, and a lot of people have different approaches. And something like this is interesting for actors to hear, because it helped me out a lot, you know. And then, and then, like, for me as well, and it's something where it's like, it's sometimes we'll get auditions that are like 12-14 pages as well, and sometimes you got a lot of stuff going on, and it's 3-4 scenes. Now maybe I shouldn't say this, but I regret if I didn't. I think that's way too much, you know, especially in the first stages of things, and especially if nobody's watching the whole tape. They watch it, go, oh, he's right, he's not right. If we can condense it, then we can really focus on giving exactly what it is that can show the essence of who that person is. And maybe it's my, maybe something I got to work on, that I've got to try and bring that to, whether the first scene's a mundane scene where not much is happening, you know, got to try and find a way to do that. But I wanted to say that, you know.
Yes. All right. Well, casting directors, no more 14-page self-tapes.
Well, now I'm not going to get a single audition.
Guy, I can't thank you enough for being a guest on the podcast. It was wonderful having a conversation with you today. It was very enlightening.
Well, that's very kind of you. Yeah, no, thanks, Joanna. Thank you for having me on, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank you for listening today. I hope you found the episode enlightening. It's really my true desire to share a unique perspective on the casting process and help you feel more confident and inspired. The podcast is available on Anchor and Spotify. For new episode updates, you can follow the show on Instagram at The Casting Session. Please feel free to share this with your friends and write a review. And tune in next week for more behind-the-scenes gold. I'm Joanna Colbert, and I'll see you at the next casting session.